Hello, I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. The UBC Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies offers a unique opportunity to explore the civilizations of the ancient Mediterranean and the Near East. The remarkably diverse faculty includes world experts who both teach and conduct pathbreaking research on the archaeology, history, languages, literatures, and religions of ancient Egypt, the Near East, Greece, and Rome, including Judaism, Christianity, and early Islam. Dr. Rumi Ahmed was recently hired as an assistant professor of Islamic studies in this department, and he is my guest today on Prof Talk. His research interests include Islamic law, exegesis and theology, and he has written several articles on war in the Islamic legal tradition. He's the author of Narratives of Islamic Legal Theory, which explores the ways in which Muslim jurists use the genre of legal theory and the language of law to argue for competing grand narratives about how the God-human relationship ought to function in society. Dr. Rumi Ahmed joins me now in the CITR studio. Thank you, Rumi, for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with talking about your relatively new role as assistant professor here at UBC. You have joined us from the Colgate University in New York. How has the transition to UBC been for you, and why did you choose to work and live in Vancouver?
It's been fabulous in just about every respect. Everything from the university to the department to Vancouver. I mean, the weather has been phenomenal. The city has been fantastic. So the move has been really, really special. And coming to UBC was kind of a no-brainer. I mean, the department, the Classical Near Eastern Religious Studies department that you just mentioned, I mean, if you list down the number of expertise, you know, the amount of expertise inside that one department, I don't know if that's anywhere else in North America. I mean, you could take classes in Greek and Arabic and Latin or mythology or classics. You could take a class in Plato or in modern Islam. I mean, the department is fantastic. Everyone works together, then they're able to create a major that I'm not sure has a parallel.
That's fantastic. Now, your present work explores the nexus of law in the Quran interpretation between the medieval and modern periods. But before we get into the specifics of your research, I think we need a few simple definitions of perhaps what the Quran is. The first part of your book is titled From God's Speech to Islamic Law, Defining the Quran. What did you write in that first chapter?
Let me see if I can sum that up in about 30 seconds or so. The Quran literally means something that's recited. And so, like anything recited, there's a lot of controversy around what things mean, how interpretation is supposed to work, how do you get the right interpretation. And, you know, that's all well and good when it's something abstract, but the Quran also includes laws in it, and these laws are, at least in theory, supposed to be applied in some way or another. And sometimes the laws contradict one another, and sometimes laws are abrogated, and sometimes laws aren't. And throughout Muslim history, Muslims have argued in different ways about which laws should be applied and how they're supposed to be applied. So in that chapter, I took a look at some of the ways in which medieval jurists argued that law is supposed to work when deriving it from the Quran.
Okay. And so you also write about the miraculousness and inimitability of the Quran in your book. What did you mean by that? Can you expand?
Sure. The Quran claims to be a miracle. And in the story of Islam, Muhammad came as a prophet in a long line of prophets, Jesus, Moses, Abraham, and each of these prophets came with something special that denoted their prophecy, that proved their prophecy to their communities. So like Moses parted the Red Sea and he had a staff that turned into a snake, and Jesus brought the dead back to life, among many other miracles. Muhammad didn't do any of those things, and people would ask him, you know, bring me something to prove that you're a prophet. And he said, well, what I'm bringing is the Quran. But what does that mean? Like, what's miraculous about the Quran? The Quran states that what's special about it is that no one else could make something like it. But then people write books all the time. So what does it mean to be inimitable? What does it mean that no one else can create a Quran? Does it mean that no one else could actually write, like, the actual words in the way that they're ordered. Is that what's inimitable? Is it a meaning that's inside the words of the Quran that people have to extract? Is that the inimitability? Like, what is it that's so special about the Quran? And the answer to that question has results in real life. If the inimitability of the Quran is in its wording, in, like, the exact words and which it is written, well, then the Quran, for the most part, is miraculous in and of itself. The actual book that you're holding is something really special, and you couldn't reword it and retain the inimitability. But if the inimitability is in the meaning that people extract from the Quran, well, that means that there's one particular meaning, and only that meaning can be right. And you need a special class of people who can interpret that one meaning. But then when they say that meaning, well, that can't be the Quran, because the Quran is inimitable, and you can't put it into any other words other than what's in the Quran. And so it gets particularly sticky when you come to law. How do you determine the law from the Quran? If it's inimitable in its wording, then you should presumably be following it literally. But if it's inimitable in its meaning, then is there one meaning? And what happens when people have differences about what that one meaning is? So that was the idea. That's what I explored in there about how is the Quran a miracle?
So let's just back up. The Quran is written in Arabic. And can you talk about that in the sense of the kind of Arabic that it's written in? So we know it's classical Arabic, but but also in when we're looking at interpretations or translations, that there is issues with that, given that the Quran is written in a certain language, and the majority of the world doesn't speak necessarily classical Arabic.
So. Right. Well, this also has something to do with inimitability. I mean, this has been a debate since the beginning of the early days of Islam, is, well, can you translate the Quran into a different language? If it conveys the same meaning, what's the harm? But if the inimitability is in the actual Arabic terms, then you can't do it. And still retain its miraculousness. So the Quran was an oral transmission that was progressively revealed to Muhammad. It claims to be a divine revelation. So the angel Gabriel got this revelation from God and then gave it to Muhammad, who then expressed this revelatory experience that he had. And people around him collected these revelations, and after his death put it together in a definitive book. And over time, that book became, you know, people had different versions of this book. That book became redacted into one official authoritative codex. And that's the Quran that more or less we have today. There are some changes. There are some diacritical marks that make it a little bit easier to read. And over time, the Quran, that the actual physical book, started to become more and more important. Whereas before, the concept of a book was foreign. Once it became a book, it started to become more and more important in the lives of Muslims. And like you said, most people don't read Arabic, but the book still means something to them. This is their link to God. And so, you know, gradually the book in its meanings became more important than the actual physical text of the book becomes really important to people. And they hold the physical text itself to be sacred, so that any affront to the integrity of the text is by proxy, you link it right back and you say, well, that's actually an affront to God, because this is my only link.
I'd like to talk about a few terms that we hear often. One of them is sharia, and the other one is fiqh. And sharia, which is loosely translated as the religious law of Islam, and fiqh is translated as Islamic jurisprudence. What wider definitions of these terms can you provide us with?
Sharia, literally, it's a good question, because we hear about sharia law, and there's a lot of fear about sharia law. Sharia literally means a path to a watering hole. It's a very loose idea about how human beings ought to function in society. They're supposed to run by certain rules and regulations. You should ideally pray to God. You should not backbite. You shouldn't steal. All of these are kind of moral parts of Sharia law. And the Sharia is taken from the Quran and the sayings of Muhammad. And I think on its own, those are not problematic ideas. But the Quran and the sayings of Muhammad also contain very specific laws about For instance, adulterers are supposed to be punished. It's a capital punishment. It's not necessarily, sorry, the death penalty, but it's a, what's the word? It is a public crime that that is prosecuted in public by the public sphere. There are laws about the thief. Like if you steal, according to the Quran, your hand is supposed to be cut off. So there are these aspects of Sharia law which threaten people and make them fearful. Now, over time, Sharia, the concept of the laws of Islam, have been captured in books of fiqh. And fiqh means jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And jurisprudence is the science of explaining how you apply laws or when you apply laws. And there are books of jurisprudence that say, yeah, you know, the Quran says you're supposed to punish the adulterers, but really it's so hard to punish to prove adultery. You have to have four witnesses who witness the act of adultery, and then if they're contrite or if they swear to God they didn't do it, then you can't punish them. So really, yeah, it's on the books, but it can never be enforced. And there are others who say, books of fiqh, books of jurisprudence, they say, actually, no, it's in the Quran. It should be enacted. You should punish adulterers, you should cut off the hands of the thief. All of these are different ways of explaining the Sharia. Like, you could, according to one explanation, not follow any of the laws in the Quran and still be following the Sharia, because you would be in the spirit of God's, you would be following what he wanted you to do, which was to be an upright person. And that ultimately is the Sharia. And there's the other extreme of fiqh, of jurisprudence, that says, no, you have to follow everything literally. Whatever it says, you absolutely have to do. And then there's a whole spectrum in between. And so when you, all of these people writing jurisprudence have competing ideas about Sharia. And they all wrote them in these enormous compendiums of fiqh and jurisprudence for centuries. They're huge, and they deal with every single little topic that you can imagine. And what's important for us to know, looking at these medieval texts from before, is that this is not the way that people lived. Nobody abided by a book of jurisprudence. This was a particular jurist's understanding of the Sharia and his explanation of how the world should work, not how the world does work. It doesn't matter if in his society people were punished for stealing or not. If the jurist thought that it should be the case that someone is punished, then he would write that in his book of jurisprudence. And if he thought that it shouldn't be punished, then he would write that in his book of jurisprudence. These are idealized versions of how Sharia should be implemented in Islamic society.
So it sounds like Sharia is much more complex than most of us think that of it.
Well, we come to ideas of law with a very modern sensibility of nation state, that there is a sovereign and there is a law of the land, and that law is then implemented unilaterally and to all persons, regardless of race, creed, gender, what have you. In Islamic society in pre-modern times, there was no such thing as a nation state. And what happened was, if you had a problem, you would go to a judge, and the judge would look at a book of fiqh and say, this is what I should do. This is what I'm really going to do. And the judge might follow the book of fiqh or might not. And if you didn't like the ruling of the judge, you could go to another judge. And that judge might rule differently. And you could have a completely different answer. And sometimes the judge would say, look, if you come to me, I'm not going to give you a very favorable ruling. You should really go to that guy. He's going to be much, much nicer to you. And we have a collection of the rulings of these judges. But even those we're not sure about, because chances are, whenever they, if they wrote down a ruling that was a little off, they just wouldn't write it down in their register. And or they might rule a certain way, but write down in the register, you should rule in this way in the future. So a lot of these things are up for, it was a very fluid system.
You know, your research focuses on how changing legal mores that accompanied the colonial enterprise affected how Muslims approached the Quran as a legal document. Can you expand on that?
Sure. You can notice that there are certain times in Muslim history when you look across the 1,400 years of religious writings, that there are certain times when major traumas affect the discourse from there on out. So there was a major civil war amongst the Muslims. And from then on out, things just changed. They wrote differently. The Mongols came. And the way that Muslims understood themselves and understood others changed forever. And one of those major traumas is colonialism. Muslims had empire since almost the beginning of the Islamic religion. And then all of a sudden, these foreigners came in and destroyed their empire. And not only did they sack the countries, now you have non-Muslims ruling over you across the board. And it was a deep shock to Muslim sensibilities, because there was always this understanding that Muslims have empire. That's what we do, because we're right. And God gave it to Muslims from the very beginning. If we don't have empire anymore, there must be something really wrong. Either, like, you know, Muslims had been doing something very, very bad and God was punishing them by taking away their empire, or Muslims had to do something to prove that they were worthy of empire. But regardless, this was seen as a shocking event, something really traumatic. And the way that they approached the Quran ever after was shaped by not only colonialism, but the colonial discourse. So along with colonialism came certain ideas about, and certain Enlightenment ideas about how to argue properly, about how to read properly, about how laws are supposed to be understood. And the way that Muslim society functioned changed. No longer did you have these kind of loosey-goosey courts that were somewhat fluid. Now you had a civil law that, in many countries, you had a civil law that was run by Islamic law and a kind of systematized Islamic law across the board. So that if you wanted to divorce in Delhi, you would get the same response with the same case in Nishapur or something. I mean, in some other city, there was civil law ran by Islamic law, but it was all codified at that point. And then there was a criminal law that ran by British or French law. And anywhere you went in the empire, if you committed murder, you would, theoretically at least, have the same result if you went to a judge in any part of the empire. And so Muslims started to understand their law in the same way. And they were like, okay, Islamic law says you cut off the hand of the thief. Well, that must be the law in all times and all places. And soon after colonialism, you start to see Muslims having this turn back to a pristine, pure Islamic law. And they said, well, if we applied Islamic law across the board, maybe we would be worthy of empire again. And so anti-colonialist movements and religious rhetoric found themselves in close proximity. And people were using religious rhetoric to justify anti-colonialist movements and saying, if we get rid of the colonists, we'll be able to implement Islamic law. Well, what's Islamic law? You'll notice that a lot of the leaders of these revolutions were not scholars. They didn't know what Islamic law said, but they believed that if we apply Islamic law, everything will be just fine. So the anti-colonialist movements were ultimately successful in one way or another, and the colonialism is now officially over. But that discourse remains of needing to apply Islamic law in order to justify empire. But the definition of applying Islamic law now has changed from the court system to nation-state codified blanket Islamic law, the same in one place as it would be another, whereas that was never the case prior to colonialism.
Do you discuss that in your book?
I don't, but okay. I do discuss it in another book that's coming out, which is, as far as I can tell, it's the first argument for a solo scriptura reading of the Quran. It's by an Indian scholar by the name of Shah Wali Allah. And he was in contact with a lot of colonists and the British. He was arguing at the court level and traveled across the Muslim world. And his explanation of how you should read the Quran is very similar to Enlightenment notions of proper reading, in that there is one particular message inside the text that can be extracted without recourse to any exterior knowledge. So, like, you should be able to... You shouldn't need any saying of Muhammad. You shouldn't need any knowledge of Islamic law in order to get the pure meaning out of the Quran. He encouraged people to go to the Quran. He was actually one of the first people to make a major translation of the Quran into Persian. that actually caught on. And so he encouraged people to come to the Quran on their own and to get that one pure meaning. He was confident that people would get the one true meaning. Well, his book is taught all over the world in completely different contexts. The rather conservative Deoband school teaches his book, and the school, the Nadwatul Ulama, which was created to counter the conservatism of Deoband, they also teach his book. And the Taliban study his book. And reformists study and claim Shah Wali Allah. There were certain branches of Al-Qaeda that were studying Shah Wali Allah. And so peaceful people, reformists, conservatives, everyone's claiming him because he's saying, if you go to the Quran, you will get that pure, pristine message. And so everyone going to the Quran is going to get what they think is the correct message for themselves. But this only occurs... This type of thinking only occurs after colonialism.
That's great. I want to quickly ask you about something that I found very interesting in your background. You're heavily engaged in text study across faith traditions, most notably as a board member of the Society for Scriptural Reasoning. Can you define for us what scriptural reasoning is?
Yeah, scriptural reasoning is an idea that difference doesn't need to divide. That major competing... there's a professor here, Aisha Chaudhry, who also teaches Islamic studies. She calls it competing cosmologies. Charles Taylor calls it strong evaluations. When people really, really differ on something, rather than paper over the differences or focus on the commonalities, you study together those things which you differ upon. And through that study, you will be able to understand the other person and develop a relationship with that other person such that even if you don't agree with them at the end, you respect their position, their point of view. And so scriptural reasoning came out of Jewish scholars studying Torah together and arguing about it and coming up with different ideas and competing ideas. And in the process of argumentation, coming to, you know, something special happens in the room where you get this great respect and love for one another. And so the idea is, well, what if you expand that to Christians and Muslims? And so the Society for Scriptural Reasoning involves text study with Muslims, Christians, and Jews, studying their texts and not apologizing for it, not looking at the similarities. The motto is fellowship, not consensus. You can believe whatever you want, but in arguing for your position, you begin to open up new pathways of understanding and new ways of thinking about your own text as well as another's. And one rather exciting offshoot of scriptural reasoning has been scriptural reasoning civic practice, which has kind of taken off in the UK, where committed religious practitioners come together over a shared problem that they're having in their community. And they see if the texts don't speak to them. And together they can come up with some type of balanced solution to their problem that speaks to all stakeholders. And so that, you know, maybe everyone's not 100% thrilled, but they can move forward in a way that's mutually beneficial.
That's great. I want to quickly ask you about the courses you're teaching next term. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah. In the spring, I'm continuing a course that's a year-long course called The Heritage of Islam. So that is Religion 340. I do the pre-modern parts, the Quran, the sayings of Muhammad, theology, and law in the first semester. And then I do mysticism and modern Islam in the second semester. But I'll also be teaching a course on Islamic law that starts from the earliest times up through the modern period. That course is an upper-level course and can be taken as a grad course also. And it's an exciting time here because now with myself and Professor Chaudhry also who's here, we're now offering several classes on Islam. Next semester, Professor Chaudhry will also be teaching two classes, and there will be a special class on the Quran in the fall that she'll be teaching. So there's a lot of offerings now for anyone interested in either the religion or the practice of Islam.
That's great. Thank you, Rumi. It's been such a pleasure to have you
My
here
today. My pleasure to be
here. This is Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've just been speaking with Professor Rumi Ahmed from the UBC Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies. For more details about his research, please visit www.cnrs.ubc.ca. If you'd like to hear an audio or video podcast of the show, please visit proftalk.ubc.ca or email us at prof.talk@ubc.ca. Next week, I will continue this kind of discussion with Dr. Rabbi Robert Dom, who is currently the director of the Iona Pacific Interreligious Center at the Vancouver School of Theology, right here on the UBC campus. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.